From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, comic method acting, Charles Grodin tells us how he went from playing the heavy on TV westerns to landing starring roles in The Heartbreak Kid and Midnight Run. Also, One Day to Save the World. Dennis Hayes organized Earth Day back in 1970. Coming up, Hayes tells us about the plans for Earth Day 1990. Rock historian Ed Ward plays us some records for the holiday season, and book critic John Leonard reviews the new memoir of critic Edmund Wilson written by his daughter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. A spokesperson for the sheriff's office in Jacksonville, Florida, says a package mailed to NAACP offices there contained a bomb that was similar to three other bombs that killed two people in recent days. Bomb squad officers disarmed the device today inside the Jacksonville offices of the NAACP and removed it to a secure area. There were no injuries related to that bomb. Romania's isolation was completed today when the border with the Soviet Union was closed. Pierre Vickery in Zagreb, Yugoslavia, reports that troops near Romania's border with Hungary have been placed on full alert.
An Austrian businessman in Temesvar made contact with the outside world a short while ago and described the city as in chaos. There's no food, no light, no electricity. Troops have been seen loading hundreds of corpses into trucks, presumably for burial in mass graves. The death toll could reach 2,000. The secret police are conducting house searches looking for the protest leaders. One officer and several soldiers are alleged to have been executed for refusing to fire on the weekend demonstrators. So great was the opposition that military units from other parts of Romania had to be brought in to restore order. For National Public Radio, Pierre Vickery reporting.
The White House today called Romania's bloody crackdown on political demonstrators totally unjustified. According to reports, dozens and maybe hundreds were killed when the Romanian government used police force against protesters. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has more from the White House.
The White House called the killings a brutal use of force against the protesters. There is still no confirmation on the numbers of dead. According to presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, the Romanian government has imposed a news blackout. He acknowledged that there is little the U.S. can do since the U.S. has no leverage with Romania's hardline communist government. Still, Fitzwater said the administration is consulting with its allies about what might be done. A White House statement said the repressive measures taken by the Romanian government are totally unjustified and stand in stark contrast to the positive changes taking place elsewhere in Eastern Europe. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
East Germany's prime minister announced today that the historic Brandenburg Gate will open before Christmas to allow Germans to pass through the Berlin Wall on foot. Hans Modrow made the announcement after a meeting with West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl. Modrow also announced that West Germans would be able to begin visiting East Germany without a visa on Christmas Eve. Senator Kennedy said today that U.S. military aid to El Salvador will undergo an urgent review when Congress returns next year and asked for an immediate evaluation of the assistance program. Kennedy has asked the General Accounting Office for an assessment of the $85 million in military aid provided this year. On Wall Street, stock prices were lower with mixed trading. This is NPR News. An Amtrak train carrying more than 100 people hit a truck and derailed today near Stockton, California. Three people were killed, 54 others were injured. An Amtrak spokesman said the train was going about 70 miles an hour when it hit the truck. The cause of that crash has not yet been determined. The accident happened in a dense fog. In Carrollton, Kentucky, closing arguments are set for tomorrow in the drunk driving murder trial of Larry Mahoney. He's charged with crashing into a church school bus in May of 1988 and causing the ensuing fire that claimed 27 lives. Bob Hansen reports.
Larry Mahoney is accused of the worst drunk driving accident in U.S. history. A Kentucky jury will have to decide tomorrow if Mahoney should be punished for that crash. In closing arguments, defense attorneys will admit Mahoney was in fact drinking when his pickup truck ran the wrong way on the interstate and crashed head-on into the First Assembly of God Church bus. But they'll say Mahoney is not responsible for the 27 who died on the bus. His attorneys will say the 1977 Ford bus was unsafe when it burst into flames, trapping 24 children and three adults. On the other hand, the prosecution will say there would have been no ruptured gas tank, no fire, if Mahoney hadn't been drinking and driving the wrong way on Interstate 71. For National Public Radio, I'm Bob Hansen in Carrollton, Kentucky.
President Bush says the $14.7 billion deficit reduction bill he signed into law today is consistent with his pledge not to raise taxes. That measure raises $5.6 billion in new revenue. It also reforms Medicare payments to doctors and keeps across-the-board spending cuts in place until February. By signing the bill, Mr. Bush effectively ended a months-long battle between the administration and Democrats in Congress over the inclusion of a cut in capital gains tax that is favored by the administration. Israel has reportedly bought $36 million worth of oil from Iran to help free three Israeli military men being held in Lebanon. Spokesmen for Israel's energy, foreign, and defense ministries are refusing to comment on that report. It's NPR. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Perhaps the dumbest career move Charles Grodin ever made was turning down the leading role in The Graduate. They were willing to pay him only $500 a week, and he was already getting twice that as a guest star on TV westerns. Dustin Hoffman negotiated the fee up to $750, and you know how that story ends. It took Grodin a long time to establish himself in films. He had supporting roles in Rosemary's Baby, Heaven Can Wait, and It's My Turn. In the years the movie roles weren't coming, he wrote, directed, and produced for TV and the theater. He also starred on Broadway in Same Time Next Year. Now Grodin is best known for his roles in The Heartbreak Kid, King Kong, The Lonely Guy, and last year's hit Midnight Run, in which he co-starred with Robert De Niro. Charles Grodin has written an autobiography called It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here. Although Grodin is now thought of as a comic actor, he didn't start out in comedies. One of his early auditions was for a TV action series called Hawk about an American Indian detective.
Oh, I was at the very beginning of my career. I think I was in my early 20s, and they had me come in. There was a new, I think it was CBS, had a new series, an adventure action series starring an American Indian detective called Hawk. I knew that he was a character that had a knife strapped to his leg under his pants, and that if he didn't like something you were doing, he would leap in the air and kick you in the face. And they were having me in to talk about being on this series, and I didn't know what part it was. So there were some people in there from the network and two or three people, and I was really raw. I hadn't done hardly anything, enough that they were interested in maybe be playing a part there. And they told me all about Hawk, how he was this American Indian, and he, like, leaped over this and threw people over that and mostly kicked you in the face. And then he told about this woman that he had an involvement with and another woman that he had an involvement with, and I was sitting there nodding my head and really hadn't said anything. And then they were looking at me as though they expected me to say something, and so I said, well, you know, it's interesting, but you've now described three parts to me, none of which I'm even remotely possible for. Why exactly are you telling me all this? And they said, well, what do you think an American Indian looks like? And I realized that they were actually talking to me about being Hawk, this Indian guy who kicks you in the face. So I did a real quick turn about thinking, God, I could be like a star of a big series and kick people in the face. He said, what do you think an American Indian looks like? I said, like me, exactly like me. But I think I paused too long, so they got the guy who was in the waiting room when I went out, Burt Reynolds.
Yeah, right. Now, you even played the heavy on an episode of The Virginian.
I played a lot of villains in westerns. I never left my feet and kicked anyone in the face, but I was in a lot of westerns. It was just necessity. I had co-authored and directed an off-Broadway musical, and we had a disastrous opening night because the costume lady hadn't been paid, and and she stole the costumes. So the police had to go after her, and we just had a show that really looked like it was going to be a success. It was a disaster, and I had a baby daughter at the time, and I just had to make a living, and I went out to Hollywood and found that all they really had was dominated by westerns. So I became a cowboy, and I had never ridden a horse or anything, but there I was. I was this cowboy.
But you were the bad guy a lot.
I was always the bad guy because the star was the hero.
Right. Were you good at being menacing?
Well, you know, after this was in 1966, 67, I went out there. By that time, I had so much rejection in show business, I was very good at being menacing. the one thing that all the young actors could do was play rage and menace, because that's what they felt. We were so shut out all the time that you could only say when they didn't want you, thank you very much. You could never really express all this frustration. So a lot of us were good villains.
Have you ever heard overheard conversations about your looks in terms of whether you would have made it as a good leading man?
I try to get into these rooms where they're having these meetings so I can overhear what they're saying, but they usually catch me. Even today, if I'm out in Hollywood, I try to get around the back door of a studio to see if I can overhear some conversations about my looks. But it's hard to get in there to overhear them.
Mm-hmm. My guest is actually...
What do you mean? Where would I go to overhear conversations about my look? Are they having them somewhere? You mean, would you put that a different way?
I see your point.
Yeah.
Right.
Have you ever overheard anything about how much money you have? No, I've never overheard anything about that. Have you ever overheard anything about your weight? Yes, I did overhear the other day my wife and my daughter were talking about, is he fat or what? No, he's not, just the way he's standing. I overheard that.
Well, I figure there's some things casting directors discuss in front of you and some that they don't, but things that you find out anyways, whether they discuss it in front of you or not. Have to be discussing, well, I don't know, is he handsome enough for this
there
role?
There was a, yeah, they discuss. That's everything, and you know, one of the blessings is that you don't hear all the things that they're saying. I mean, I have an agreement with the people that represent me, is I really only hear if they want me. I mean, they definitely know not to call me every day and tell me all the things that they don't want me for. You know,
right.
That movie with Paul Newman, that one with Clint Eastwood, that one with Ryan O'Neal and Robert Redford, they don't want you for that. Thanks for being in touch. Thanks. And there's one coming up they want Jack Nicholson for. They don't want you for that. Oh, good. Good. Like good to know that. You know. And Michael Keaton, that Batman thing, they wanted him. They didn't want you. Oh, really? I kind of assumed it when I saw the movie because we hadn't heard anything about it. Yeah, well, they definitely didn't want you. They didn't want you for the Nicholson part in that either. Right. Okay, good. Well, thanks. I like to hear all this. No, I don't. I really try to not to think about it. That's why I think I spend so much time thinking about sports.
Oh, yeah, right.
Because I'm afraid of what I might think about.
Well, how did you get from being like the bad guy and auditioning for action series to specializing in comedy, which it seems is what you've done over the past few years?
Well, I was really trained as a serious actor, and Elaine May, really with The Heartbreak Kid, knew me socially, and it just was intending to star me in whatever movie she was going to direct. She just felt that she had this guy that she was going around telling everybody how good I was, and everybody said, if he's that good, why don't we see him? And he says, well, when he has a chance, you will see it. But show business is so much about opportunity that, as I've said, that if Dustin Hoffman hadn't been The Graduate, nobody would know what he was doing, because he was about heading out of the acting profession around that time. He was really, he had actually done some off-Broadway shows, but just before that, he had about given it up. And I really lost interest in it, right around 1965. It just was too difficult. You could be in a success and not get anywhere. But I was really put into The Heartbreak Kid as a comedy player and then totally perceived that way. Before that, it was just, whatever you could do. I never wanted to be in a sitcom. I just didn't like that kind of rhythm playing. I was doing something different, and I wouldn't have fit in. So that's an extremely murky answer to your question.
Well, explain what it is that you feel like you do different from, for instance, the acting in a sitcom.
Well, a sitcom is based a lot on rhythm. There's a setup and there's a punchline, a setup and a punchline, and I don't really do that. I just basically try to be alive in a situation, and I'm not really wanting to do jokes. Most of the humor that comes out of me has nothing to do with a funny line. It has to do with just being there. So I'm not, somebody said to me once, do you practice these looks in front of a mirror? I don't even know what I'm doing. I just know that I'm alive there in the situation. And that's what, if you ever, when you saw Candid Camera, these people weren't actors, but they were alive in a situation, and their normal, honest responses were funny. And that's basically what I'm doing. I've really been trained to be able to be as though I were in life on the screen. And that's what I'm basically doing. Just existing there, and then whatever's going to come out of me. Now, you know, if somebody like who is not maybe a humorous person in life did that, it wouldn't necessarily come out funny. But if you took a person who was humorous in life and they could do that, it probably would come out.
My guest is actor Charles Grodin, and he's written an autobiography called It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here. So you're trained in the method. You studied with Uta Hagen and with Lee Strasberg. Do you feel like you use the method in doing comedy roles?
Well, and to the extent of basically what it is that I function as an actor the way I'm functioning right now. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm responding personally to you. That's basically at the heart of it. It's a personal response. Now, the difference is I'm making up, I mean, these are not written lines that I'm saying to you now. Well, most everything I say is written. I actually wrote down all these things and hoped you'd ask some of these questions. That's the difference. And then the skill is to be able to take the lines of the script and make it your own and make it come out of you naturally. But it's so you do apply it all the time.
When you were making Midnight Run with Robert De Niro, can you compare how you each prepared for your roles?
Well, in terms of the background of the part, Bob does a lot. He would like to live the life of the character. He actually went on Drug Bus with a bulletproof vest because his character did this kind of thing. Even though he didn't do it in the movie, this was part of being the character of Jack Walsh, who he played. I don't really do that. My focus is much more on what's going on right there at the moment. I just accept the fact that I'm an accountant who embezzled money from the mob and gave it to charity. I just accept that, and then I'm there with this guy. I just accept the situation, but I don't really go around embezzling money from the mob in preparation for the role.
So what kinds of differences does that make for when you're actually doing a scene together?
None whatsoever, because what he does is it just brings him to the point where he can be alive in the moment, and what I do brings me to the same point, that we're both doing the same thing. If there's one thing unique about us working together that I found different than a lot of other situations, that I believe in something I learned from Paul Muni in a book that Paul Muni wrote years ago, that you should, if you have a scene and say it's 3 pages long, for example, mm-hmm. you could learn those lines, but there's learning the lines and there's learning the lines. And I believe in learning the thing, so you could do it 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You could say, just as tools, that you could say these words so fast. So I believe in going over the thing and running it, just as the words, not how you're going to do it, not the interpretation, not the meaning, nothing like that. Just the tools, the words themselves. I would do that an unending amount of time to get it so solid with me that I know it just as quickly as I know the alphabet or counting to 10 or my own name. And Bob agrees with that. So we would sit there and maybe do that 100 times, which is a lot. I mean, it takes a very long time to run a 3-page scene 100 times, but there would be no limit, because he understood that once you do that and you go in front of the cameras, you're completely free to come alive and do anything. You're never thinking about your words. And too many actors, they think they've done the work, but they haven't done it. And it affects their work. And I've seen friends of mine, they say, what do you think? And I say, I don't think you know the lines well enough. And they say, no, I know them. I knew them at home. This is different, though. There's cameras. There's 50 people around. The distractions are tremendous. You've got to be so solid before you can really be free and be creative. And that's something I think he understands, and it's what I do, and it had a lot to do with the freedom you see in the playing.
Well, I want to talk with you more about acting and about your life, but first we'll take a short break. My guest is actor Charles Grodin. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Charles Grodin is my guest. When you shot The Heartbreak Kid, and you talked about that as being a kind of breakthrough role in comedy for you, you read for Neil Simon. He loved your performance. Then you were reading for him again, but this time you thought you'd already gotten the role, and you were doing what you describe as exploring the character.
Right.
He hated your reading in this,
right.
And he wanted to fire you, which,
right.
which he didn't do. But can you describe what you were doing the second time around?
It's the difference between performing, which you sometimes, in that case, certainly had to do to get the part, and, you know, it might be something like this. I might say, Mr. So-and-so, I'd like to talk to you about your daughter. I really like her, and I'd really like to, you know, maybe you and I could talk, and I could, you know. Now, that's like actually talking to someone and trying to do something. But if you were just exploring, it might come out more like, Mr. So-and-so, I'd like to talk to you about your daughter. I like her. I've really met her. In other words, what I'm doing the second time is I'm kind of just letting the situation and the reality of what it is I'm talking about. It's a work process that I'm just trying to feel my way through it. I'm not trying to be effective. I'm just working on my own. But the mistake I did is you don't want to work on your own in front of Neil Simon. He'll think that's what you're going to do. In fact, Eddie Albert, I don't know if I mentioned that in the book, but he too said, is this the guy that's playing the part? You know, I think you kind of owe it to the writer until rehearsals start anyway to let them keep seeing you perform it. But since I'd already performed the whole script for him, and actually did a screen test and performed it some more. I thought that they had already seen that, but I was giving them credit for more sophistication than they really had.
You played the gynecologist, the first gynecologist in Rosemary's Baby, which was directed by Roman Polanski. And you tell a really funny and also very interesting story in your book about a pause that you wanted to put in a line. Would you tell that story and
yes.
explain the significance of the pause
yes.
to you?
Yes, Mia Farrow comes to me for help and says that she feels that these witches and demons, whatever it is, are pursuing her. And at the end of this long tale, which sounds insane to me as a doctor, I'm supposed to say, you may be right, and then I'm supposed to make some phone calls to help her. Well, I felt if she told me that whole story and I said, you may be right, the audience would say, like, well, why? It's very unlikely. He'd just believe that. So when she finished the story, I looked at her for a long time as though I was considering what she'd said, and I very slowly said, well, you know, you may be right. And then Roman Polanski, the director, leaped up and says, take out that pause. And I explained my point, that which I just made here. And he says, no, it's not more believable if you have a pause. It's less believable. So I really didn't agree with him. It was my first picture, and he was a famous director at the time. And I kind of did it with less of a pause. At the end of the day, I went up to him and I said, you know, Roman, I was thinking about what you said, what you told me this afternoon. And you know something? And then I took the longest pause you can imagine. And I said, I think you're right. He says, good, that's right. That's what I'm saying. I said, did you just believe me? He says, yes. I said, but I'm lying. That's what I wanted to do in the scene. And he looked at me, and you could see he was trying to figure out whether he hated my guts or admired me. And he decided he admired me. He threw his arm around my shoulders. Come with me, watch the film from the previous day. And we go in, and the next day, after he had time to sleep on it, he realized that he hated my guts after all. And for the rest of the movie, I said, Roman, he said, I don't care what you do. No matter what I would want to ask. Because that's a European director. There's a problem with some of them. I haven't had that much experience with them, but they are more autocratic, just the same way, you know, certain men of other cultures are. They don't really believe in give and take. They believe more in you take, they give.
Well, this must be a constant source of anguish for an actor deciding whether you should go with your own intuition on how to play something or go with the director's advice.
It doesn't really come up for me. My relationship with directors that I work with, and it's been true for several years, is I like them to see what I'd like to do. If they don't like it, that's fine. But I don't really have that was a unique problem. Generally speaking, I can't really think offhand of anyone asking me to do something that I thought was inappropriate. There was a play I was in once where they wanted me to, when the woman opened the door, they wanted me to fall into the room as though I was leaning against the door. And I said, gee, I really would rather not do that. And the director said, I know that's going to get a laugh. I said, well, I know it's going to get a laugh from some people in the audience too, but it's going to really take away the credibility that this is an actual person. It will look like an actor doing a bit. And he took my point, and I didn't do it. I mean, when people say they got a laugh, and you hear performers say this sometimes, they count it a laugh if somebody laughs. But if you have 800 people in an audience and three people laugh, I consider like 797 people were just bored by what you did. That's not a laugh. So the demands that I put on what's a laugh are different. But generally, if my understanding with directors now is I will have things to say, I like to try this and do this and whatever, and you be in charge and you choose and you make the judgment, and all I want you to do is to see it. And it works very well that way. Everybody, as long as it's very clear that they're in charge, the director is comfortable, and I'm comfortable because he has to be in charge. I don't want to try to be in charge. If I'm in charge, then I'll be in charge. But essentially, it's the director who's in charge.
There have been times when you were unable to stop yourself from laughing. You tell the story in your book of when you were playing with Ted Knight, who played Ted Baxter, the newsman on the Mary Tyler Moore Show,
in a
soap opera, an afternoon soap opera, and you had a lot of scenes together, and every time you'd be on the set together, you would just break up. Was that because of the knowledge of the absurdity of the whole program?
Well,
we were very
good friends off screen, and we really had a lot of laughs off screen, but the real problem was that we were playing, as you do in many soap operas, a variation on one scene, and the scene was that he was my boss, and I would constantly come in and ask him if Irene Forsythe, who was my mother-in-law in the show, the character's name was Irene Forsythe, if she had anything to do with me getting my job here at Forsythe Industries, which of course she did, you know. And this scene, we must have played this scene, I don't know what, 12, a dozen times over a period of time. So when I'd come in and I'd say, you know, can I have a word with you? Yes, Matt, what is it? Did Irene Forsythe have anything to do with me getting my job here at Forsythe Industries? Now, Matt, we've discussed this before. And, you know, and we had discussed it many times. And Ted kind of used like an English accent on the show. Oh, Matt, I don't think this is anything we should be discussing. And we couldn't do it. We just couldn't do it. I mean, here we, you know, like 2 weeks later. Ted, can I have a word with you? Yes, Matt, what is it? I just was thinking this afternoon, and I was wondering if, did Irene Forsythe have anything to do with me getting my job on Forsythe? Now, Matt, we couldn't do it. We just like look at us. Oh, please don't ask me this question again. Yes, she got your job. You stink. You couldn't get a job on your own. All right, leave me alone. You know, but we never said that. We just kind of like made it another scene. But the hardest time I ever had in a movie is something I didn't write about in the book, but you could almost see it in the movie of The Heartbreak Kid when I have a showdown scene with Eddie Albert, and he tries to buy me away from marrying Sybil Shepherd, and I somehow get into a speech about how I was in the service and during the war, and that I, to show what a tough guy I am, I say, you know, when I was in the armed forces of our country, and I fought every moment for 3 years, and I fought every moment of those 3 years. And the line in the script was, not overseas, unfortunately, because of a minor back condition. And I couldn't get through that scene because I was so, you know, I fought for our country for 3 years. Not overseas, unfortunately, because, and I couldn't get through it. And even now, if you look at the movie, you'll see, like, at that moment, I'm, like, staring at the floor, like, biting my tooth off. You know?
You said that sometimes you tell a joke with such a straight face that people take you seriously. Has that gotten you into any trouble recently?
I think it's always gotten me into trouble. It's something I've tried to rectify. I don't know. I mean, I make an assumption about things sometimes that what I'm saying is so absurd it couldn't possibly be taken seriously. But, you know, people read expression more than they do content. And I've learned that, and I really don't like that. I mean, I really don't like to mislead people or to fool people or anything like that. I mean, and it's happened many times. In fact, you know, many people, you know, have been uncomfortable. I remember Warren Beatty, who's a pretty smart guy, saying to me, I don't know what if you're kidding or not. Well, when he said it to me, it really struck me because he's very quick. He's a very hip guy, and if he couldn't tell, then, you know, what am I trying to do? I'm not trying to put something over on people. I'm trying to amuse people. If they really don't know what I'm doing, then I have to do something differently. And I have in recent years attempted to not have that happen.
So you don't do that anymore?
No, I really try not to do it. I mean, I can still fumble into it. Yeah. I remember the first time I met Elaine May, she came in and said, Gene Wilder says such wonderful things about you. And she being Elaine May and such a famous comedic person, I said, boy, you're really coming on to me, aren't you? She was so embarrassed. It was so tense, you know. And it wasn't until like later in the afternoon that she started to see, oh, I was kidding around. But I really am very careful. I can't resist it sometimes. But in a speech, I followed Jean Simons, Senator Paul Simons' wife, in a speech in Pittsburgh, and I said that I had directed in 1969 the only television special with Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, Tell Him I Said Hello. You know, that I could do because I figured, like, everybody knew that was a joke, you know.
Actor Charles Grodin. His autobiography is called It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be film director and screenwriter Jim Jarmusch. His movies include Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, and the new film Mystery Train, which is set in Memphis and is haunted by the ghost of Elvis. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On April 22, 1990, people all over the world will focus on the problems facing the global environment and their possible solutions. Coming up, we talk to the man behind Earth Day 1990, Dennis Hayes. Also, just a few days before Santa makes his big appearance, rock and roll historian Ed Ward plays some records in which Santa appears. And book critic John Leonard reviews Near the Magician. It's a memoir of the literary and social critic Edmund Wilson, written by his daughter, Rosalind Baker Wilson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The White House says the president has approved the sale of three U.S.-built civilian communication satellites to China and lifted bans on U.S. export-import financing of U.S. business activities with China. This action removes a major part of the economic sanctions the U.S. imposed on China following that government's crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators last June. Today, the White House continued to defend the president's decision to send a secret high-level delegation to China last July. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The president ordered the secret trip to China to make the point that U.S. sanctions were not just public posturing, according to White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater. Fitzwater argued that the Constitution gives the president authority to conduct secret diplomacy, not just toward China, but in general. Fitzwater said, "There have been trips you don't know about. There will be more." Arguments like these don't satisfy the president's congressional critics. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said the July visit to Beijing and another visit this month, quote, make a mockery of our profession of concern for human rights. He called for full disclosure of China contacts by the Bush administration so Americans can fairly judge the wisdom of its China policy. At the White House, spokesman Fitzwater was asked whether the high-level visits had produced any significant improvements in China's behavior. His reply, we're still waiting. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Police in Jacksonville, Florida today disarmed a package bomb at the NAACP office. It was the fourth in a series of mail bombs that have killed a city councilman in Savannah, Georgia, and a federal judge in Birmingham, Alabama. Today in Washington, FBI Director William Sessions held a news conference to discuss these bombings. NPR's Jim Angle has more.
Administration officials say there is no clear indication yet of the motivation in the recent string of bombings, but race appears to be the leading suspicion. Attorney General Thornburg said that for now, authorities are concentrating on race as a possible motive, and FBI Director Sessions said that is in the back of all our minds because all the bombs have been sent to those involved in civil rights matters. Authorities are concerned that additional letter bombs may have been sent but not yet arrived, and Sessions urged everyone to exercise caution.
I see no reason to panic, but I do see every reason to be very cautious and to use good common sense in dealing with packages and providing for your own safety and care.
Sessions warned those who receive suspicious packages to either call the person who appears to have sent it or law enforcement authorities, but not to open such packages. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 2 points to close at 2,695.61 on volume of 186 million shares. Declining issues led advances by 2-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Santa has been part of black pop music ever since it's been made, from Louis Armstrong's Christmas in Harlem to Curtis Blow's Christmas Rapping, which was, by the way, the first rap record to sell a million. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says, if you want a cool Yule, listen to this.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can count on me. Please have snow and mistletoe.
What you're hearing here is something of a rarity. It's the Pilgrim Travelers singing I'll Be Home for Christmas, and it's probably the only recording I've ever heard of a black gospel group singing a Christmas song. Now, black popular music, that's a whole different thing. Ever since Charles Brown, singing with Johnny Moore's Three Blazers, took Merry Christmas Baby to the top of the charts in 1947, 48, and 50, rhythm and blues singers have known that Santa Claus would take care of those who took care of him.
Yes, it's Christmas time. I wonder what Santa Claus gonna bring me this year. Yes, it's Christmas time. I wonder what Santa Claus gonna bring me this year. If he'll just bring my baby home, then that will ease my every care.
Joe Liggins was just the first of a long line of blues singers in the late 40s and early 50s to make that appeal. Of course, blues singing and the life surrounding it being what it is, some people, like Roy Milton, were aware that there were built-in risks when approaching the fat old man.
Well, if you see Santa Claus, please tell him this one thing for me. Yes, if you see Santa Claus, please tell him this one thing for me. If I've been a bad fellow, no, I didn't intend to be.
Of course, if you wanted to make sure that you got what you wanted, it didn't hurt to put the guy who might give it to you into a good mood, as Oscar McLally and his Honey Jumpers seem to realize.
Dig that crazy Santa Claus with his red suit on. Dig that walk, that crazy talk. Man, oh man, he's really gone. Dig that crazy Santa Claus with his bag of toys. Drags his sack through a chimney stack. All the little hip cats jump for joy. Cool it, Rudolph, cool it. With your nose aglow, tell those groovy reindeer when Santa starts to blow.
Go, go!
Dig that crazy Santa Claus. Well, I do believe he will bring some crazy toys, so you better be good this Christmas Eve.
And if you were going to praise Santa, what higher praise could there be than to assume that, give or take a few reindeer and a few more pounds, he was a lot like yourself, which is to say, a pretty hip guy.
Old Santa Claus is a mighty good man. He hails in from a distant land. He's got good things for everyone. Let's jump in and have a little fun. Do the Santa Claus boogie. Oh, watch his feet. He's got all the people dancing in the street.
That was the Voices, who knew how cool the old man was way back in the mid-50s. 4 years later, the Marquees, not the famous Stax group, felt it was wise to warn their friends with what they knew about the jolly old soul.
Vicious Santa Claus, a young guy, riding down his rocking ship. Six jet engines and a overdrive. Him zooming, coming across the sky. If you've been good like I know you should, Santa this year's gonna treat you good. But don't you try none of your lame tricks, cause this year's Santa, he's done got hip. The boy that's west of the wall, with this year, he's done got hip. Now put down his reindeer, and put down his sleigh, and Rudolph on the golden day. All you.
Of course, every year there are those who feel the sting of disappointment, and in order to save face, they make excuses.
You talk about Santa Claus, you want to know what it's all about. Santa Claus got drunk last night, everybody tried to throw him out. But I want to tell you, folks, how it all began. Santa stopped at a neighbor's house and started drinking good gin. Now while I was with him, I named a few. I left to name some of them whiskeys that Santa was drinking to you. It was way back in the ancient age, down in Mid-Spring Valley.
I suspect that this guy, Clyde Lashley, might have found a little bit of coal in his stocking before he recorded that song in 1960. But times were changing, and even Santa Claus was undergoing an image change. Before long, James Brown was insisting that Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto, where the children who have been good, despite the misery of their surroundings, get a little something to reward them. When department stores started integrating their Santa Clauses in the 60s, I remember some diehards wondering how kids would react to a black Santa. If the records I've just played mean anything, and they're only a small selection of what's on hand, it's that the spirit of Christmas knows no racial boundaries and that Santa comes in all shades. Here's hoping he comes to you this year.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Dennis Hayes can take some of the credit for starting the environmental movement in America. In 1970, Hayes organized Earth Day, a nationwide day of marches, demonstrations, speeches, and community and public projects, all aimed at calling attention to the damage people had done to the environment. Now, two decades later, Dennis Hayes is organizing another Earth Day, this time with people from more than 100 countries taking part. In the years since the first Earth Day, Hayes has worked as an environmental lobbyist, a senior fellow at the World Watch Institute, served as director of the Solar Energy Research Institute during the Carter administration, and been a professor at Stanford University. I asked Dennis Hayes why he thought it was time for another Earth Day.
It's been 20 years now since that first Earth Day, and a huge number of new issues have come onto the agenda, most of them global in nature. Global warming, threats to the ozone layer, rainforest destruction, acid rain, ocean pollution, things that nobody even thought about at the time of the first Earth Day back in 1970. And so we thought that, granted the enormous amount of concern for these issues around the world, this was a good time to try to organize people once again into a gigantic event that sent a very strong message to our political leaders and our business leaders that these are serious issues and need to be taken seriously.
Do you find that there's a certain cynicism now about large events, a cynicism that didn't exist, say, back in 1970, that a large event is a big public relations event with corporate underwriting, and it calls attention to the sponsors, it calls attention to the cause, but all of this money goes into the event, money that perhaps could have been used to be directly channeled into the cause itself?
Well, it was a concern when I first started thinking about putting such a campaign together once again. I was quite convinced that a major Earth Day campaign was doable, but I wasn't sure that it was worth doing, granted array of other things that you could put the same amount of time and energy and resources into. But in talking with environmental leaders across the United States and around the world, I found that virtually nobody shared that questioning. Everybody seemed to think that the timing was exactly right and that this could be something that would make potentially a really profound difference in the way that people viewed the planet.
Dennis, I think I should ask you what your trash looks like.
Well, over the years, I think it's gotten to be less and less. It's aided by the fact that the community that I live in, Palo Alto, California, has a very good comprehensive recycling program that's a curbside program, so they make it very easy for all of us to separate out our aluminum and our glass and our paper and our plastics. And by the time that you get all of that out of there and you compost the remaining organics, trash tends to be a pretty small part of what leaves the house.
What's absent in your trash? I mean, do you use styrofoam cups? Do you use plastic baggies?
No, we don't use either styrofoam cups or plastic baggies. I think that the criterion that we try to use in terms of selecting items that are going to be used one time and then disposed of in one way or another is to try to focus upon things that can be reused first, recycled second. And of course, the first question before you acquire it at all, you should be asking, is this necessary? If you can get by without using something at all, then you've avoided the problem altogether.
You say that biodegradable plastics have become anathema to the environmental movement. Now, I've been seeing plastic bags that advertise themselves as biodegradable. I thought I'd be doing everybody a favor if I bought it. Why is it not good?
Well, both biodegradable bags and the alternative out there in degradability, which is called photodegradable bags, things that come apart when they're exposed to sunlight for a long period of time, when mixed with other plastics, make it impossible to recycle those other plastics. Moreover, because of the increased sort of frailty of the degradable items, they actually use substantially more plastic in making a biodegradable bag than they use in making a non-biodegradable bag. The real purpose of biodegradability and photodegradability, I suppose, is to try to stop roadside litter. But if you put it in a sanitary landfill, which is where 99.9% of the garbage bags go, that sanitary landfill will not expose it to much water, and it won't expose it to any sunlight, in which case it will neither biodegrade nor photodegrade. You'll simply be using more plastic as part of the disposal process.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you're doing now is trying to pressure the industry to be more environmentally responsible. And one technique that you're involved with using is the Valdez principles. And this is a set of 10 principles written by environmentalists and socially conscious investment managers, created as guidelines for corporate behavior in terms of the environment. What's the point of these? So that people who are socially conscious investors will have a sense of who to invest their money with?
Well, our long-term objective is, in fact, robust and fairly far-reaching. We would like to have environmental audits eventually become as important a part of the investment process as our financial audits today. And the Valdez principles are an important step toward getting companies to agree to allow outside auditors to come in, to monitor how they've been performing environmentally over the course of the past year, and to file a public report on them. It's our belief that companies that behave in a socially responsible fashion, that do not cause problems with, say, Superfund sites for disposal of toxic wastes, that are not in violation of air pollution and water pollution or occupational safety and health laws, and are otherwise behaving responsibly, are in the long term going to prove to be far better investments than companies that do not.
So you intend this to be an incentive for industries to become more environmentally responsible?
Very much so. And sort of stage one at it, before we get to those sort of profound levels, is to sort of bring pressure upon industry to say, over and beyond everything else, the investment community really cares about these things. And if we can get enough sources of investment lined up behind the Valdez principles, it will send a very strong signal, I think, to industry that they should start paying attention to them. Sort of followed the same model that the South African activists did in trying to change corporate policy toward the Republic of South Africa.
This, in a way, seems to be an admission that industry changes when it's profitable to do so, as opposed to because of some larger moral reason.
Well, every company needs to compete with the other companies that are manufacturing the same good. And if one company decides to do it in a way that costs it more in an upfront capital investment because it wants to do it properly and cleanly, and all of its competitors do not, ultimately it's going to lose out in the marketplace, unless there can be some way that we attribute some sort of a premium to cleaning up the environment. What we're trying to do is to make sure that the signals that are sent to industrial decision makers are such that what they get rewarded for is congruent with what makes the world a better place.
What first involved you in environmental work?
Well, I suppose I first started paying attention to environmental issues because I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, in a land of extraordinary beauty that was being, in some large measure, raped and pillaged by the extractive industries. I then had some sort of academic exposure to Rachel Carson and to Paul Ehrlich, and what maybe crystallized it all together and made me think that there might be something here that could constitute the basis for important social change was the oil spill in Santa Barbara in 1969, which galvanized this huge public outpouring and seemed to say that the destruction of things that are beautiful is something that a huge fraction of the society is willing to take steps to prevent.
What do you think you were, looking back, naive about when you first became an environmental activist?
Well, there were a great many things that none of us knew back in the early 1970s because the research simply hadn't been done. In 1970, for example, we thought that the great threat to the ozone layer was likely to be nitrogen oxides from high-flying airplanes, and somewhat on that basis stopped the development of the SST. There was, I think, something approaching a consensus in the scientific community that that was right, but the consensus turned out to be wrong, and some years later we discovered that nitrogen oxides were not much of a threat, but that something that we hadn't even considered in 1970, chlorofluorocarbons, were the real threat. That's something that nobody in the movement knew in 1970, and so we embarked upon a course that didn't address it. And I'm sure we're going to come up with several other kinds of problems in the future that emerge that nobody knows about today, but that we have to maintain a degree of openness as new data arises and as we find out what the real threats are and what the real opportunities are.
You have to be willing to say you've made mistakes.
Exactly.
How have you reevaluated your tactics in terms of trying to get government and industry to respond to environmental issues?
Well, I think the biggest strategic change that we're making this time versus 1970 does not so much deal with either the approach to government or industry, but the approach to people. After the first Earth Day, there was a split within the new environmental movement between people who were concerned with lifestyle and people who were concerned with politics. And the two factions hated one another, and it got to be something of a war. Ultimately, the political people won, and folks who contribute a dollar today to an environmental group will see 99 cents of it going to lobby Congress, to engage in the regulatory rulemaking procedure, to engage in lawsuits, and to otherwise try to influence one of the three branches of government. But virtually nothing has gone into trying to change the way that people lead their own lives. In retrospect, I think that that was a mistake for two reasons. One, because the individual choices that we make as citizens are enormously important. I mean, if everybody bought the most efficient refrigerator available in the size of his or her current refrigerator, you'd eliminate right there the need for 12 large nuclear power plants or more than 20 large coal-fired power plants. And you can say that same sort of thing about everything from automobiles to air conditioners to houses to light bulbs to what have you. So it makes a difference what we choose to do. The other, almost more important reason to try to encourage people to lead lives that are more congruent with their values, however, is that that reinforces their values in a way that a political abstraction does not. An environmentalist who recycles, I believe, is a stronger environmentalist who will stay in the battle for a longer period of time and be more effective as a proselytizer of his values to his neighbors and to others.
Dennis Hayes, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dennis Hayes is the chairman of Earth Day 1990. It's scheduled for Sunday, April 22nd. This is Fresh Air. Time to see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Lots of stories tonight, including the story of the Redoubt volcano up in Alaska. It continues to simmer today. The scientists we talked with said if Mount St. Helens volcano some years ago could be considered a 10, then Redoubt is a 2, but only so far. The leaders of East and West Germany got together to talk about the future of their countries. And we'll talk with the writer Mark Helprin, who has written a storybook version of the Swan Lake story, the basis for the ballet. Helprin tells his story in the voice of an old man. Said it was easy for him to do that. He just thought about his father. He also describes his collaboration with the illustrator Chris Van Osburgh.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new memoir about one of this century's best-known journalists, literary and social critic Edmund Wilson. It was written by his daughter, Rosalind Baker Wilson. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Edmund Wilson's daughter, his oldest child from the first of four marriages, has nothing to say about the work of our greatest man of letters, except that the quality and quantity of that work prove he wasn't a drunk. This is self-deception, but it's charming, like her memoir, in which there are many drunks, half famous and the other half family. There is also a range of behavior, from merely dotty to entirely mad, that gives the lie to anybody still telling you that all wasps are anal-retentive stuffed shirts. These wasps, in Red Bank, in Talcottville, in Provincetown, on Cape Cod, were as messy in bed as they were heroic in the library. As for Boston, ye gads, writes Rosalind to her father from her editorial offices at the Houghton Mifflin Publishing House, If it isn't incest, it's perversion. If it isn't perversion, it's a mad member in the attic. Wilson himself, in the diaries he managed to keep between marriages and masterworks, didn't always tell the truth. Wicked Rosalind will do so. She's been a spy from almost the very beginning, when her father, she says, used to carry me under his arm like a book and often forget me. Near the Magician isn't a daddy dearest. We gather that Wilson was difficult, but not impossible. With his female radar and bouts of sadism, his depending for money on his own mother, his manipulating of the women around him, his playing tricks with coins and hearts, his fierce loneliness. Of course he neglected her. Nevertheless, she says, I felt secure with my father, that somehow he'd continue to exist. Here was a force that, however unpleasant at times, wouldn't go away. When Rosalind, for reasons unspecified but easily guessed at, suffers a nervous breakdown, her father's there for her. He saw me through gallantly, she says. He'd had a breakdown of his own and told her about it. Whereas her mother, the actress Mary Blair, died at age 50 of alcohol and tuberculosis. I'm proud to be her daughter, says Rosalind. I was in awe of her courage, but I never loved her. I was 23 when she died, and all the time we had spent together barely added up to less than 6 months. The child grew up, loving John Dos Passos, contemptuous of Edwin O'Connor, terrified, like all of us, by her father's third wife, Mary McCarthy. Nabokov and many other Russians show up in these pages, as well as W.H. Auden, Margaret Mead, Dwight MacDonald, E.E. Cummings, Humphrey Bogart, and Wanda Landowska. But what we really have is a reaching out, late in her own life, of a little girl for the magic trickster. I think of my father sometimes, she says, of his taking me to Bennington where I waited on tables, choosing the furniture for my room, including an awful chair. You've got to have a chair. Standing by me when I had my wisdom teeth removed, coming to the hospital with a great bottle of Meyer's rum. When I woke up drunk from the ether, he was equally so. In her opinion, great men of letters should die in houses like the Stone House and have their coffins exit through majestic doors. I agree, but it's very sad. They were all so smart, and they didn't know how to love.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Near the Magician by Rosalind Baker Wilson. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, film director Jim Jarmusch talks with us about his movies Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, and Mystery Train. Also, some advice on shopping for TVs, VCRs, CD players, and other home electronics. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.